Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. In March, Shopko, a small town version of Walmart, announced it's closing nationwide. And that could hit Wyoming communities hard.
She's like, Gert, there's no place in Powell to buy tennis shoes now. You know, just little things like that are going to go away.
We'll have three stories on how Upper Colorado River Basin states, including Wyoming, are building more dams and pipelines to stave off coming droughts.
Dam building historically has been sort of like, it's my water, I want to keep it, the heck with everything else.
Wyoming is more racially homogenous now than it's ever been.
We'll also look into issues surrounding the availability of public defenders on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. If you've never been to a Shopko, it's sort of like a small Walmart. You can get groceries, apparel, and lawn products all in one place. And they're usually found in small towns. Back in March, Shopko announced it will be closing all its locations. This is a big deal. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska looked at how towns throughout the Bighorn Basin are being proactive about the news.
Christine Beckish is the executive director of the Powell Economic Partnership. When she found out that Shopko was closing, she says there were a couple of products like pet, health, and beauty supplies that immediately came to mind. Without Shopko, people may not be able to get those things in town anymore. But one hit a little closer to home, children's footwear.
I'm not sure where I'm going to get my daughter's shoes, yes.
In Wyoming, a total of 13 communities are impacted. Four of those are in the Bighorn Basin. Those four communities are joining forces with the Wyoming Business Council and Main Street America Institute to try to figure out how to mitigate the economic impact before it becomes a problem. So the communities of Warland, Grable, Thermopolis, and Powell conducted an online survey and focus groups to find out more. Beckish also toured shops in Powell with local leaders, retailers, and business owners to see what products were needed. Murdoch's, a ranch and home supply store, was part of that tour.
She came to us and they walked around the store with me. We showed them everything. They were concerned about the Shopko closing.
Kurt Scott is the manager of Murdoch's.
She's like, Gert, there's no place in Powell to buy tennis shoes now. You know, just little things like that are going to go away.
Scott decided that he would add more outside-type products like fertilizers and apparel, toys, and of course, kids' tennis shoes.
They'll have tennis shoes, you know, maybe just a couple lines, but a few pair anyway. So, you know, we can justify kids running around in tennis shoes instead of boots.
Just recently, the Wyoming Business Council and Main Street America Institute presented the results of all the work done in the Bighorn Basin. Christine Beckish says it was affirming.
Made me feel good because I was like, oh, check, we're on the right track for the recommendations.
The first short-term recommendation is to make sure the community has the products that may have previously only been at Shopko, like pet supplies, wellness and hygiene, and lawn and garden products. Check. The next one was developing a regional and local business directory. Beckish says Powell is working on a shop and dine map. So again, check. Some long-term recommendations included building out an entrepreneur ecosystem.
We'll be highlighting our local makerspace more and also partnering with Cody for an entrepreneur startup challenge and a Park County startup challenge.
Trying to revitalize the retail of small towns is not only a problem in Wyoming, says Amy Quick. She's the Northwest Regional Director for the Wyoming Business Council.
This is a national issue that states and communities are facing across the country.
As online shopping becomes more and more popular, both small shops and large retail stores are struggling across the country. Quick says towns are losing their sense of community.
We can be proactive to try to make a change and keep our communities vibrant and livable.
And it seems that the Bighorn Basin may be on the right track as the communities push to showcase what they have to offer. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kudelska at the Center of the West in Cody.
A $7.5 million competition to develop products out of carbon dioxide is less than a year away from its final stage. The NRG COSIA XPRIZE competition will take place at the Integrated Test Center outside of Gillette. Five teams are nearing the point where they can set up operations. Well, I mean, Public Radio's Cooper McKim speaks with Marcus Extivore about how teams are progressing and what's still to come.
It's absolutely not a lot of time, and people are definitely racing. The part of the design of the XPRIZE is to ask for a very aggressive schedule, and we're just seeing that, you know, the rubber hits the road now, where people are really racing and pushing hard, not just to get something done, but something. Remember, they have to be able to operate safely, be able to get permits, be able to pass all of their inspections. So the race is really on, and I think we're seeing a lot of there's just a lot of time pressure on all the competitors.
From what you've heard from groups, does it seem like most everyone is on track, or is there still a little bit of space to be at that point?
It depends. Every competitor is in a slightly different place, but I think overall it's fair to say no one's really comfortable right now. Everybody is a little bit nervous about their timeline. You know, they're counting the days and the weeks to figure out how they can execute on time. And we're monitoring that carefully. There should be some of that tension in the competition, which we think will drive people forward.
Could you remind me of all the teams competing in the XPRIZE that will be up at the Integrated Test Center or the ITC?
Yeah, sure. So we have five projects that are on track to be tested at the ITC. So very quickly, we have a team called Breathe. They're based in Bangalore, India, and they have a technology to turn carbon dioxide into methanol, which is an industrial chemical, but you can also use it as a replacement for fuel. There's a team called C4X from Suzhou, China. They make foamed plastics and other polymers out of CO2. We have a team called Carbon Capture Machine. They're based in Scotland. They make a mineral powder. It's called precipitated calcium carbonate. So calcium carbonate is chalk. It's a white powder. And that can be used in everything from paints to paper to wallboard to flame retardant building materials and other building material applications. There's a team called Carbon Upcycling UCLA. They make concrete. They have a way of injecting CO2 into concrete. So they're in the building materials category. And the fifth team headed to the ITC is called Dimensional Energy. They're based in Ithaca, New York, and they make replacement fuels and chemicals, starting with something called syngas, which is an industrial chemical, a fuel actually, that can be either used directly as a fuel or used as a basic input material to make a whole host of other materials.
Where should groups be ideally at this moment with a little less than a year to go?
There isn't really an ideal state. I mean, well, some of the milestones that people are working on now are making sure that their permit applications are being reviewed and filed. Teams do not need to be operating now. They don't need to be commissioning now. They don't even need to be building now. But we're really emphasizing that everyone needs to focus on their permits and making sure that those are in order. That sounds kind of mundane, but it's actually a necessary step to getting anything done. The other thing I'd say, though, is in parallel with all those steps, there's the team's actual engineering design and fundraising and actual building that's going on at their own site.
So groups will eventually all have something set up at the Integrated Test Center site. When do you think the last group or all of them will have hit that milestone?
You know, it's really hard to say, but I think the most realistic we think for us is into late fall and winter. So no doubt some teams will be earlier out of the gate and want to take a more relaxed schedule. Some will be there at the last minute and, you know, some may even be late. That's a real part of this. And, you know, every team's got to figure that out. But as we approach the submission deadline, I think we expect the activity to intensify and more activity to be happening on the site.
At this point in the competition, what are you excited about?
Well, we're excited for people to do it and we're excited to see what it looks like. We've been talking about what these technologies could be. We've seen them at small scale and we've got to know the competitors pretty well. And now we're really looking forward to just getting these pieces of technology on the ground. It'll be really exciting to see them in action. And I mean, we can't stress enough. This is not happening anywhere else. There are no clusters in the world of CO2 conversion technologies that look like this. And when these competitors are operating at the ITC, this will really be a world-leading spot for this type of solution. So, I mean, because we've been on this journey with the competitors, we're very excited for them to get to this milestone moment of having a running piece of equipment. And I also, you know, I can't forget it's also a competition and they are all really going for it and believe they can win. And we're excited to see them operate sort of in the presence of their peers and see how they can push themselves in the moment to try to get the best possible results and data that they can, given their systems. So we're really looking forward to things like that.
Well, thanks, Marcus, for taking the time.
My pleasure. Happy to do it.
When we come back, we'll look into the availability of public defenders in some parts of Wyoming and discuss long-term care in the state. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. This week, officials from Wyoming's Office of the State Public Defender spoke to the legislature's Joint Judiciary Committee about how its workload is hurting its ability to provide representation. The officials say they need more staff to be able to effectively help Wyoming residents in need of legal assistance. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler reports on how the issue has led to some legal action.
Public defenders provide legal representation to people who can't afford private attorneys. They're appointed by a judge to represent those accused of a range of crimes, from misdemeanors and juvenile offenses to serious felonies. And because of that, they see a lot of clients. Diane Lozano is the director for the State Public Defender's Office. She says since 2007, she has seen her office's caseload grow by 2,000 cases a year, and her office can't find enough people to handle that increase. Lozano says some of her offices in the state are working well above their maximum workloads, and the concern is that they are not representing their clients properly. Lozano recently spoke to the legislature's Joint Judiciary Committee about the problem.
It became apparent that the crux of the ability to provide ethical representation from a public defender standpoint is manageable caseloads, manageable workloads.
Lozano says their current workloads are far from manageable, especially in places like Campbell and Natrona counties. The Public Defender's Office reports that as of May 1st, the four full-time attorneys at Campbell County's Public Defender's Office are working at a 168% caseload maximum. That's about 470 assigned cases a year for each attorney and doesn't include cases that roll over.
My attorneys in Campbell County are handling 3/4 more of a caseload than their ethical obligations allow.
The obvious solution is to get more attorneys. Part of the problem is finding enough money to convince local attorneys to take on these cases.
In Campbell County, I think local private attorneys do well. The hourly rates that they're paid, I've been told, are $200 and $300 an hour. Our ability to pay contractors right now is about $50 an hour. And it's $50 an hour to handle a pretty heavy caseload that limits their ability to handle the rest of their law firm practices.
Lozano says she's also had trouble hiring enough attorneys to do the job. After fearing that clients weren't getting properly represented, in frustration, Lozano sent a letter to circuit court judges in May that stated her office will no longer take on misdemeanor cases in Campbell and Natrona counties.
The letter was my intention to start the conversation. Of course, the letter had some strong language in there about we're at a point where we can't accept misdemeanors.
The proposal was not well received in Campbell County, where circuit court judge Paul Phillips found Lozano in contempt of court and fined her $1,500 a day until the problem is resolved. Phillips is not able to discuss the case while it's ongoing, but fellow circuit court judge Wendy Bartlett told the committee that the letter came out of the blue.
We received this letter on May 1st, same day that it was in effect. We had no notice, no phone calls.
Senate Judiciary Committee Chairwoman Tara Nethercott, an attorney herself, expressed frustration about Lozano's action and asked why her office and the judges didn't discuss solutions before getting to this point.
As a member of the bar and as a chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I'm disappointed at this turn of events, that this is a situation that we couldn't come together and solve more thoughtfully.
Phillips did tell legislators that he issued a stay in the contempt charge, which means the case is essentially on hold and also stops the daily fine. He says both sides are trying to find a solution. And in fact, there is now a roster of 14 lawyers who have volunteered to be assigned cases in Campbell County. However, officials say few of them have experience with criminal cases. Phillips says that both parties want to ensure that people have access to attorneys if they can't afford one.
How we get there right now today is a point of contention, but we all want to see the same thing.
The issue now has the committee's attention, and Nethercott says the committee will look at options that could attract and retain more public defenders.
I believe that this committee can come up with some solutions to provide additional guidance, either to reduce the load on the state public defender's office, find additional funding, and other holistic remedies.
They suggested a variety of options that could help, like loan forgiveness or changes to the pay scale. Other ideas include taking crimes off the books or removing jail time from lower-level offenses. Laramie Representative Charles Pelkey, who handles criminal cases, says that should be an easy fix.
Maybe it's time for the legislature to look at that and try to get those statistics and take those periods of incarceration off the statute so that we can lessen the load on public defenders.
Both the Public Defender's Office and Campbell County Circuit judges say they will work together to find solutions. It's an issue that's not likely to go away anytime soon. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Catherine Wheeler in Gillette.
Next week, the Wyoming legislature will begin to address a growing and expensive problem in Wyoming, long-term care. As you've likely heard, Medicaid costs in Wyoming are a growing concern, and a lot of that is because it's the way many use to pay for nursing home care. Sam Shumway is the director of AARP Wyoming and says the lack of available long-term care is another problem. He tells me that they want to present some solutions to lawmakers.
You know, we became sort of acutely aware of this a couple years ago when the Department of Health issued a long-term care study that showed that right now the state's paying about $130 million a year for long-term care for our aging population. If they do nothing, that number is going to jump to over $300 million in the next 10 years. And we saw that and we said, that's a lot of money. And for a state that's already sort of strapped, you know, what can we do to slow that growth? What can we do to mitigate that? And so that's when we started talking about it and thinking about it.
So what drives up that cost so quickly?
One of the primary drivers of that is nursing home care. So if somebody retires and they can't afford to pay for their own long-term care for whatever reason, they'll end up in a nursing home. And Wyoming Medicaid pays for about 70% of nursing home beds in the state. And a nursing home stay costs between $50,000 to $70,000 a year. And so that's one of the primary drivers of that. Now, when we talk about mitigating that growth, in-home care, aging in place, home services is really one of the best ways to do that. And so we're looking and really trying to promote both funding and different innovative ways that we can encourage and promote aging in place, keeping people in their homes where they want to be.
My guess is the services simply aren't available in a lot of our state. Am I right about that?
Yeah, definitely. That's a challenge. Workforce, finding those CNAs or those home service providers, that's a challenge. And we've heard that from the providers. They have wait lists. They say, you know, we would love to be able to do this, but we don't have the workforce. And so one of the things that I'll just tell you about is in Wyoming, there are over 60,000 unpaid caregivers. And so these are, you know, people who are caring for a family member, loved one, neighbor, who don't really receive any state support for doing that. But the economic benefit of that service is tremendous. It's in the millions of dollars. And so we're looking at leveraging that group of caregivers to provide those services. Because these aren't, you know, these aren't high-level nursing care. This is activities of daily living. This is, you know, help with meal preparation, transportation, chores, sometimes bathing, things like that. And so other states have programs that they've developed that provides more direct support to these caregivers, whether through sort of a monthly stipend to offset some of the cost, whether that's through transportation or time off work. Or another example, Idaho has something called a certified family home, where I can bring one or two or three individuals into my home, be the caregiver for them, and then the state will reimburse me some amount every month. And when I say some amount, it's a fraction of the cost of institutionalization. So, you know, we're talking, you know, in Idaho, I think it's about $20,000 versus $60,000 for a nursing home. And so if there are things like that, you know, where we can use these caregivers to provide this support and keep people out of nursing homes, man, we really want to take a hard look at those kinds of policy proposals.
I saw on the agenda, part of the discussion might center around a role the senior centers could potentially play. Is that kind of along these same lines? Maybe you get folks from a local senior center to help out with some of these people?
Sure. Yeah, our senior centers are such a wonderful resource to communities, and whether it's through the congregate meals that they provide or the Meals on Wheels, that's one of the, you know, being able to have food security is a huge issue, especially in, you know, small rural Wyoming communities. And so we've got to keep supporting our senior centers. And a lot of these home services actually run out of the senior centers. They'll contract with a provider. And so, yeah, senior centers are huge. And the benefit that they provide to communities, the return on investment for both the senior centers and for these home services, and I would say for supporting caregivers in providing these home services is really tremendous. And so, you know, we can keep just, you know, spending money on putting people in nursing homes, or we can look at it and say, how can we get the best return on these state dollars? And I think, you know, home services is really one of the best returns. So that's why we're really supporting it.
Sam, thank you.
Thanks, Bob.
Sam Shumway is the director of AARP Wyoming. The Joint Labor, Health, and Social Services Committee meets next week in Casper.
When we come back, we'll have three stories surrounding the Colorado River. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. The Colorado River provides water for 40 million people in the Southwest, but the river is running short on water, and this is pushing some states to tap into every available drop before things get worse. In the first of a series we're calling The Final Straw, KUNC's Luke Runyon reports on a controversial effort to make one Colorado reservoir bigger.
Tyson Long drives his black pickup truck in the foothills outside Boulder, Colorado. The narrow dirt road twists and turns through pine forest and past houses with yard signs that read, "Stop Gross Reservoir Expansion."
So this is a good vantage point. We are at the corner of...
Long and his wife, April Lewandowski, live near the reservoir in an area called Coal Creek Canyon. As we get closer to the dam, they imagine trucks full of building materials barreling toward us.
People are going to get in car wrecks and people are going to get killed doing this. I'm convinced that's going to happen, and that's why I keep hitting the safety nail on the head.
Those trucks could become a reality. The utility that owns the reservoir, Denver Water, wants to increase the size of the dam by 131 feet and fill the human-made lake with more water from the headwaters of the Colorado River. From an overlook, the dam is a deep wall of concrete situated between the tree-lined canyon walls.
But I mean, you look at how the land splays out. I mean, you see why they want to do that. Is it just, it's so much wider all the way around.
If the expansion goes through, this would be the tallest dam in the state, and where we're standing would be underwater.
Like, there's nothing that we get from this. Like, we don't get the water from it. We don't get a better, like, we've never been told we were going to get a better road or a wider road.
It is a major construction project. There's, I don't want to gloss over that. It will have impacts to the local community.
Jim Lockhead is the CEO of Denver Water. The utility's been pushing for the expansion since 2003. That's when a lack of snow caused the agency to nearly run out of water in one of its service areas.
This is a project that's needed today to deal with that imbalance and that vulnerability and to give us more drought resiliency.
Safety concerns are just the beginning of the project's opposition. Environmentalists are suing, arguing the expansion will harm endangered fish. A group of local activists say the additional water will spur unsustainable population growth. And the utility is now sparring with Boulder County officials over a land use permit.
No one wakes up in the morning and says, gee, I hope there'll be a 7-year dam construction project in my backyard.
Anna McDermott also lives near the banks of Gross Reservoir. She spoke about that permit at a public meeting in March.
This project represents an effort by Denver Water Board to actually grab water while they can before federal legislation and management of the Colorado River Basin is imposed.
What McDermott is referring to is a disconnect in the watershed. States downstream, like Arizona and Nevada, just signed a new agreement that keeps them from becoming more reliant on the river. Meanwhile, upstream in Colorado, Wyoming, and Utah, the opposite is happening.
There really isn't unused or excess water out there.
That's University of Colorado water policy researcher Doug Kenny.
So every new water project we build is undercutting the reliability of every other water project we've already built.
A long-standing compact gives upper basin states the legal cover to continue developing projects like the Gross Reservoir expansion. Kenny says that adds additional pressure to the river.
I used to think that limiting factor would be the economic cost of these projects, but currently there's little evidence to suggest that's what stops these things. You know, it's politics, and it's how well mobilized the political opponents are to these projects.
Meaning to justify the costs of these big builds, water managers throughout the Colorado River's upper basin have to convince a skeptical public they're absolutely necessary. I'm Luke Runyon in Greeley, Colorado.
The state of Wyoming is moving forward to build or expand several reservoirs on the Green River, a main branch of the Colorado River. This would help ranchers prepare for worsening droughts as climate change escalates. In the second part of our series, The Final Straw, Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports more dams could actually contribute to global warming.
It's late May in Wyoming. It snowed last night, and more snow is expected. That's why it's good that Big Piney rancher Chad Espenscheid is behind the wheel. The roads are sloppy, and Middle Piney Creek is running high.
There's a lot of water.
Yeah.
Well,
it seems like it's starting to flood.
Yeah, it's just wet.
And that wetness is nerve-wracking for ranchers like Espenscheid.
It's been a cold, long winter, and the cows and calves are really needing some sunshine about now. Yeah, I've got quite a bit of sickness.
Sickness that could mean he'll lose a lot of newborn calves. There's lots of things to be stressed about in ranching. One of the big ones is water. And Espenscheid says one way to reduce that stress is to fix Middle Piney Dam. That's a dam that's fallen into disrepair at the top of this creek that flows into the Green River.
It would give Middle Piney Creek a little more of a steady flow instead of it all coming out in one shot and everybody having to really hustle around and capture it all at one time.
He says he could really use that water to irrigate his fields to feed his cows. Not only is Espenscheid a rancher, he's a water engineer and participates in a water conservation program by only irrigating when he has to. He says fixing that dam will store a modest 4,200 feet of Colorado River water. As for how dipping that small amount out of the river will affect lower basin states that also rely on the Colorado.
I don't know. I'm just kind of a Wyoming through and through, so I'm kind of worried about Wyoming, I guess, to be honest. So we got to take care of our own sustainability.
But it's not just the Middle Piney Reservoir that's going to start dipping from the Colorado.
4,000 for Middle Piney, 10,000 for West Fork, that's 14,000. Another 8 at New Fork, so that's
Jason Mead, one of Wyoming's dam and reservoir guys at the Water Development Office. He's adding up all of the acre feet of water storage the state wants to add on the Green River drainage. All told, about 50,000 acre feet on 5 new or expanded reservoirs. And then there's the 80,000 acre feet that Fontanelle Reservoir could eventually add. 130,000 acre feet total. For those of you scoring at home, that'd be enough water to supply a city of 1 million people.
Every one of these projects that we're talking about really are for irrigation shortages and trying to handle the drought situations and trying to take water when we have good years and carry it over into years that are drier.
And those drier years are expected to worsen. Long-range forecasts say heavy snowpacks are expected to melt and flood earlier and earlier, then leave ranchers with less water in the summer. That could make ranching even more of a risky business.
If we can't keep those businesses afloat, eventually they're going to have to sell. And do they get developed in the future? We don't know. But if we keep them in ranching, we know we're going to maintain that open space.
Mead says more dams could help ranchers survive the coming droughts. But some scientists say building more dams might actually worsen climate change. University of Wyoming soil scientist Jay Norton says dams that manage for flood control, for example.
They want the water drained out so that in an event of a flood, they have storage capacity. That can cause very low flows downstream that dry up those floodplain wetlands.
Wetlands that Norton says store huge amounts of organic carbon.
There's estimates that if we could raise soil organic carbon by about 0.4% per year, that we would completely offset human-derived emissions of greenhouse gases.
Think of all the trees and brush that's growing like a green snake along streams in the otherwise arid Mountain West. Wetlands can take up as little as 2% of the landscape, but they hold 15 to 30% of the carbon there. But if reservoirs hold back all the water, for recreation, say, or flood control, those green snakes will dry up and stop holding carbon. But, Norton says, managed correctly, more dams in the upper basin states could actually create more wetlands and store more carbon.
Conceivably, it could have a positive effect on downstream wetlands. If water tables are maintained relatively high, irrigation itself expands wetlands.
Unfortunately, that's not the only effect of dams on climate. One study shows that decomposing organic matter behind dams as the water level drops can produce large amounts of methane. That's a greenhouse gas that's even more potent than carbon dioxide. That's all well and good to rancher and water engineer Chad Espenscheid, but he says the positives of building dams outweighs the negatives.
Most ranchers are, you know, they're ranchers because they love their ranch and they love the outdoors and they love the wildlife and everything about it. So if you can find a win-win solution, and you know, then everybody's happy.
The question is, with all the upper basin states investing in more dams, what will the accumulative effect be? For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
Four states, Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico, have watched shares of their water from the Colorado River flowing downstream for nearly a century. But now they want to claim that promised water. In the last part of our series, The Final Straw, KUER reporter Judy Fays explores the drive behind a massive water pipeline in southwestern Utah.
Gary Turner is facing a busy afternoon at his turf farm on the outskirts of booming St. George. Customers are calling, even before he can finish greasing his harvester.
They're all looking for grass.
Buck, do you know how much Omar wants?
Red dirt and the surrounding Red Rock Country of Washington County are a technicolor contrast to Turner's crop. Acres of emerald green lawn grass that glows in the spring sunshine.
There's nothing more greener for this planet than grass.
Suburban ramblers and apartments sprout outside Turner's 114-acre farm. It's a sign this is one of the nation's fastest-growing metro areas.
I mean, we grow houses better than we can grow any other commodity.
Turner irrigates with a virgin river. It's the area's sole water source. But he says if the people moving here want lawns, they need the Lake Powell pipeline.
We absolutely have to have it. I don't know any other option.
The pipeline would be like dipping a 140-mile straw into Lake Powell halfway across the state. It would cost billions of dollars and be paid for by Utahns. The water would support nearly 100,000 new households, including future turf customers.
It's absolute madness.
Nick Scow of the Utah Rivers Council says too much Colorado River water has already been promised to too many people.
The state of Utah would have you believe there's plenty of water for all of these projects, as though we're living in the good old days.
When the river was gushing and it kept Lake Powell and Lake Mead full, Now, 40 million people rely on that stored water, and their demands and drought have strained this vital supply.
We are way beyond the budget of what the Colorado River can deliver. And when you just look at how much water is in the river and how much everyone else wants to take out, it's just not there.
But the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is proceeding with Utah's application to draw 86,000 acre-feet from Lake Powell. It's the largest of 9 proposed water projects in the Upper Basin states.
And we're up here looking the other way, whistling and pretending we don't notice.
Scow says pipeline proponents are also putting whole communities at risk by ignoring climate change. Scientists predict the Colorado's flow could be nearly one-third lower by mid-century. Instead of a pipeline, opponents say the smartest and cheapest solution is conservation.
Found us.
Lisa Rutherford lives in a St. George suburb where that idea is already embraced. Her front yard is red rock and low water plants. It's the stuff of nightmares for someone who makes a living growing sod.
We took out our front grass in 2013 and just have a little piece of grass in the backyard.
Rutherford tracks the pipeline for the nonprofit Conserve Southwest Utah.
We don't think there will be the water. We do not think that we need the water.
But Rutherford's partner, Paul Van Dam, says the problem has deeper roots, a conviction that Nevada, Arizona, and California are taking precious resources that belong to Utah.
That's almost part of the DNA of people out here. It's just like treason if you don't fight for the water that is your water.
A longtime soldier in that fight is Mike Styler, who recently retired as director of Utah's Department of Natural Resources. Before that, he was one of the state lawmakers who voted to begin the battle for the pipeline.
What they need to do, the lower states, is use their right that's allocated to them, and we will use our right that's allocated to us, and that water is there.
Back at the turf farm, Turner's harvester is peeling 2x5-foot strips from the ground, rolling them up, and stacking them on pallets. 2 tractor trailers await loading for delivery tomorrow morning, and contractors with pickups and trailers are standing by. Turner doesn't want this market to dry up.
The good book says that the meek shall inherit the earth, but they won't get no water. They have to fight for their water.
And to Turner, the answer to Utah's water problem is a no-brainer. I'm Judy Faze in southwestern Utah.
These stories were part of a collaborative series from the Colorado River Reporting Project at KUNC in Greeley, KUER in Salt Lake City, and Wyoming Public Radio.
When we come back, we'll hear about a time when Wyoming was bustling with immigrants. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. It's one of the traditions of living in the American West, getting out in the boonies and camping for free on public lands. But the recent boom in outdoor recreation means more people are heading out and putting down stakes in the region's forests, mountains, and deserts. That means the federal government may start cracking down. Mountain West News Bureau's Nate Hedgie has the story.
The Red Rock Desert north of Moab, Utah is beginning to fill up with campers. Subarus and retrofitted vans slowly roll across dirt roads searching for an open spot. James Gustine and his wife Jamie are lucky. They found one earlier this morning.
Camping in Moab it's brutal. I mean, just getting a spot can be full-on competition, and it didn't used to be that way.
It used to be a quiet spring break destination for rock climbers and mountain bikers in the region, the kind of place where you could roll in on a Saturday and not see many people. But low gas prices, a strong U.S. economy, and a population boom in some cities in the West all appear to be driving more people to visit cool outdoor meccas, places like Moab, Jackson Hole, Wyoming, and Fruta, Colorado. Many of those visitors practice dispersed camping. If you don't know what dispersed camping is, it's essentially bargain basement camping. No toilets, no electrical hookups, no designated campsite. You simply find some previously trampled upon ground and sleep right there. Gustine loves it.
It's free. We get away from the crowds. The dog can run around. Just a little more space, really.
But space is becoming increasingly hard to find. And today, the Gustines are surrounded by camper trailers and tall black live-in vans.
Yeah, it takes away from the experience. I don't come out here to be around huge crowds. That's not the reason I'm out here.
And huge crowds aren't the only problem. About a quarter mile away from where the Gustines are camping, Lisa Bryant is staring at some dirty paper towels half buried in the sand.
Okay, I'm not going to pick it up.
I mean, they could just be normal paper towels that escaped from someone's picnic.
But the way they're wadded up and stuffed into the dirt?
I wouldn't pick those up.
Bryant is pretty sure those paper towels were used as toilet paper.
So this is a spot somebody chose to bury their waste. Not properly.
Bryant is a spokesperson for the Bureau of Land Management's Moab Field Office.
You know, you don't want to be camping in this. You don't want to be experiencing this as part of your public lands. That's not cool.
Human waste doesn't decompose as fast in the desert as it does in a wetter environment like a forest. That's why the BLM recommends people dig their cat holes a lot deeper here, or they carry their waste out. Because improperly buried feces is not only gross, it's also unsanitary, and it can potentially contaminate nearby water supplies. And people are doing other ignorant things, too. They're illegally driving off the road to find quiet spots to camp. Bryant points to a tire rut that's crushed some plants.
This is just resource damage. These soils are compacted now, harder for plants to get in and grow.
All of this has spurred the Bureau of Land Management to propose restricting some dispersed camping areas near popular trails and introduce managed camping sites. For example, in Moab, the agency has long-range plans to build 5 new $20-a-night campgrounds, complete with fire rings and proper toilets. Mike Souza isn't a fan of that idea. He's a retired plumber from California, and we find him in the shade of his camper trailer. His two old red cattle dogs come over to greet us.
Lie down. No running.
Souza has been vacationing in Moab for 30 years, and he says the desert is definitely becoming more crowded. But he believes that clamping down on dispersed camping isn't the answer.
I feel like when they close something down, I say, well, you know, why? I paid taxes to be able to use this.
He feels like creating designated campsites and fee campgrounds will just drive more people to other dispersed camping areas, leading to the same problems there. Instead, Souza says people need to learn better camping etiquette.
They don't realize that this could be taken away. They think it's theirs. They don't know it's a privilege. And that's the problem.
Right now, it's a problem that's mostly confined to areas near popular hiking trails and climbing routes. So if you really want some peace and quiet, park the car, grab your tent, get off the trails, and start walking. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Nate Hedgey in Moab, Utah.
Wyoming is one of the least racially diverse states in the country. But it wasn't always that way. A museum in Evanston chronicles a time when the state bustled with international immigrants. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Jones reports.
The Joss House in Evanston has a false front, like lots of Western buildings that harken back to the 1800s. It looks like it could have been an old saloon or general store. But when you get closer, you notice there's intricate swirls painted in red and gold on the top of the porch. Around back, there's a tiny arched bridge over a koi pond and a gazebo painted with Cantonese characters.
The Joss House is a temple, a Chinese worship temple.
That's Kay Rossiter. She's the director of the Uintah County Museum, which runs the Joss House.
This particular building was constructed in 1874.
In the middle of the 19th century, the U.S. was on a mission to spread railroads across the country. At the time, droves of Chinese men were arriving in California to be silver and gold miners. That's where Union Pacific recruited them to be railroad workers. And in 1868, the brand new railroad reached the spot on the prairie that's now Evanston.
Evanston is the result of the railroad.
So Chinese immigrants were among the first citizens of Evanston and other towns along the railroad. After the railroad was done, these men stuck around to be coal miners. A few years passed, and right next to the Evanston tracks, a robust Chinatown emerged.
There was a barbershop and laundries and storekeepers and herbalists.
But anti-immigrant sentiment was growing. In the late 1800s, the U.S. passed a series of laws that barred all Chinese immigrants from coming to the United States. Newspaper opinion columnists warned that the Chinese would take jobs from white people. White coal miners believed their employer treated Chinese miners better, when in reality the Chinese were paid less and were charged higher prices for rent. But prejudice persisted, and in nearby Rock Springs, in 1885, white miners killed 28 Chinese miners, brutally, with pickaxes, and burned their homes. Newspapers called it the Rock Springs Massacre. Chinese people trickled away from Evanston over the next few decades.
They closed the mines. Of course, that was all the real work for these men, you know, to really support their families and all. And they just left, drifted away to other communities for work.
Until finally, in 1922, with only about a dozen Chinese folks left living in Evanston, a fire decimated Chinatown. Nobody knows how the fire started. Rossiter says some people think maybe the Union Pacific lit it to clear the land.
The other story is that the few Chinese people that were here were so angry at the Union Pacific that they just burned the whole thing down.
Why were they angry at Union Pacific?
Well, I assume because they had told them that they had to move. You know, we're going to reclaim this property and you need to move on or move out.
I guess, could you just tell me about that fire?
Well, that's an interesting question because I've only seen it referenced a couple of times.
Phil Roberts is a University of Wyoming professor of history emeritus.
The big problems often arose on windy days when embers from the coal-fired steam locomotives would float over and land on wooden roofs. The fire would start and it would burn.
Roberts says this happened in towns all along the tracks. Still, no one living knows exactly what happened. After the fire, most of the rest of the Evanston Chinese disappeared. Many of them moved back to China.
Wyoming in 1890, 40% of the population was foreign-born. And you look around Wyoming now and you say, gee, we're rather homogenous, but we're probably more homogenous than we've ever been.
But still, there's evidence of a different Wyoming. Before the fire, when Chinatown was already mostly abandoned, whites from Evanston raided it. They took the things left behind, pottery, photos.
All these things that people took in what I fondly call the raid, these are the items that ended up in the museum here.
The original Joss House burned in the 1922 fire, along with the rest of Chinatown. But the city rebuilt it from photos in the 1990s and made it into a museum. Rossiter says she wishes everyone in the state could see two panels that were on either side of the front door. Originally, they were covered in gold leaf and red and black paint.
And I have a lot of Chinese people from all over the world that come here to see this Joss House. I had one man from London in here, and he looked at those panels and he said, wow, he said, they must have thought they were going to be here forever. You know, and of course, I questioned him about that, and he said, well, in China, these kind of panels are only on palaces and government buildings. And here they are on this little bitty building in the middle of Wyoming.
Rossiter says you can still smell the cedar. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Erin Jones.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. To hear the whole show or individual segments, go to wyomingpublicmedia.org and click on Open Spaces. You can also enjoy the program at your leisure by signing up for our podcast there or wherever you get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor.
We always appreciate comments on the show and ideas for future programs. And we also urge you to support our coverage by going to wyomingpublicmedia.org and clicking on the Pledge Now button.
Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.